raw footage coming out of the cinema and into your ears.
Welcome to episode 323 of Raw Footage, the Stream of Consciousness film review show. So after the craziness of the Oscars and the crazy rush I was in to get everything done before the Oscars, normal service has somewhat been resumed now with a standard episode. In this show, I will be reviewing Tanner, the Australian Foreign Language Oscar nominee, which I saw at what was essentially a special screening last week, and I didn't feel the need to rush out the review of it because it's going to be one of those really hard-to-find films. I've also got a review of the new horror thriller from Gore Verbinski, A Cure for Wellness, and the Canadian floss for 2017, It's Only the End of the World, directed by the genius Xavier Dolan. So with reviews of Tanner, A Cure for Wellness, and It's Only the End of the World, let's get on with today's show.
Boy, are you in for a special treat.
Tanner is the Australian floss for 2017 and is directed by Bentley Dean and Martin Butler. For both of them, this is their first feature film as director, but they have got a long history in documentary filmmaking. Bentley Dean having directed many documentaries over the years, and the team of Bentley Dean and Martin Butler having collaborated on two previous documentaries for Australian television. Despite being submitted by Australia and directed by Australians, this film is set on the island of Tanna in Vanuatu, and tells a true life story which happened in 1987, where two young lovers in the Yakel tribe, who keep to the traditional Kastom way of life, played by Mungau Dain and Marie Wawa, fall in love. But Marie Wawa is promised as a bride to another tribe in order to prevent a war. Not wanting this to happen and wanting to stay together, these two young lovers run away and try and live together and avoid the traditional system of marriage which their tribal society is based on. This actually got nominated for Best Foreign Language Film at this year's Oscars, and it didn't win. It lost out to The Salesman by Asghar Farhadi. But it was a real, real surprise that Tanner made it all the way to an Oscar nomination. Yes, it did get an audience award at the 2015 Venice Film Festival, and it also played to positive reviews at the 2015 London Film Festival as well. And in film festivals around the world and at the Australian Academy Awards, it has also got awards for cinematography. So it did have a little bit of backing, but when you consider some of the other films which didn't make the 9-film long list and didn't get a nomination, it was a real, real surprise. Which I think is somewhat reflected in the fact that this has been getting a microscopic Gothic release into the UK. This was the Discover Tuesdays film last week at the Little Theatre here in Bath, and that one screening was the only screening available in Bath or Bristol since the film's release. And with such a small release, I didn't feel the need to include it in last week's standard episode before the Oscars, because this is a film you're going to have to work really, really hard to find. So this is kind of a bonus, an extra review, but it was in a cinema I could get to, I could see it, and it's a foreign language Oscar nominee, so I went to check out this film. But was this Romeo and Juliet story set in a traditional tribe on Vanuatu worth watching? Here are my thoughts on Tana. So it is Tuesday night, and you find me sat in Queen Square about to walk home. And I've just come out of the Discover Tuesdays screening at the Little Theatre in Bath, which was Tana, the Australian floss for 2017, which astonishingly got a Best Foreign Language Oscar nomination. I mean, everything I've been doing recently is somewhat related to the Oscars, which will have happened by the time you listen to this. But as soon as I get home, I'm going to have to finish editing and uploading the last standard episode before the Oscars, reviewing The Founder, Moonlight and Fences. It's been insanely busy, but I've just come out of Tana, and I saw this because it is not only a floss, but an actual nominee for Best Foreign Language Oscar at this year, and honestly, I just don't get it. Watching as many foreign language Oscar submissions as I do, you occasionally see patterns in what gets submitted. This is not the first film I've seen which explores Polynesian tribal culture. I mean, a few years back there was the New Zealand film The Orator, which was set and filmed in Samoa. There was also The Deadlands from New Zealand, which dealt with ancient Maori tribal culture, and even spreading it around the world. There have been some explorations of tribal culture and traditional culture in films like Charlie's Country, dealing with the Aborigines in Australia, Ixcanul, dealing with the Mayans in Guatemala, Thebe, dealing with the Bedouins in Jordan, El Alwani, dealing with the Venda in South Africa. Explorations of tribal traditional culture do get brought up in these foreign language Oscar submissions, and I'm really not sure what makes this one stand out enough that it actually got a nomination. I just don't see it. Yes, it's very impressive. There's brilliant use of an active volcano on Vanuatu. I mean, there are certain shots which are stunningly beautiful. It probably helps that this was based on a true story. I mean, a Chiron comes up at the end of the film saying this incident happened in 1987 and things have changed now. And you're also thinking, oh yeah, they did say at the beginning of the film it was based on a true story, didn't they? So maybe that has something to do with it, you know, the veracity of it. The fact that this is a true story of tribal culture maybe has some impact. But really, this comes across very, very strongly as an ethnographic documentary, exploring in detail the tribal life of Vanuatu, and often exploring this in a very blunt, very obvious way. I mean, the filmmakers went to this tribe on Vanuatu, the Yirrkal, and told this story, which happened in 1987, to the Yirrkal tribe. And at every point, we are told how this society functions. I mean, there are certain incidents and even certain characters who are specifically there. So through their eyes, you know, through people being told what is happening, we know the details of this Yirrkal society, this Yirrkal culture, the idea of the castom, you know, the traditional tribal way of life. And it's always really, really blunt. It's really obvious. You can automatically tell this incident I am seeing right now is specifically in this film, so I know how castom works on Vanuatu. There's no real need for these characters to be saying these things to each other in dialogue, but because I, as an audience member, need to know it, it's in the film. And they very, very clearly used native actors from the Yirrkal tribe. I mean, non-professional actors. I mean, even in a foreign language, a language I don't speak, I don't understand, I can tell that some of the acting is very, very non-professional. It is not actors inhabiting a role, it is tribesmen and women reciting lines they have memorized. It comes across like that, even though it's a language I don't speak. And really, what I was thinking throughout the majority of this film is, yes, this is all fascinating, but it's probably stuff which fits better in an ethnographic documentary. There's no need to make this fictionalized story, this feature film about this story, about this tribe. You would get just as much information, just as much impact, if you told this tale, this true life tale, albeit, you know, this really happened in 1987, tell it in a documentary. I don't need to have these wooden actors performing out these roles and giving clunky pieces of exposition which have no purpose other than to tell the audience what is going on. I mean, these are pieces of information which everybody involved on the scene knows, but they tell each other because we need to know it as an audience. I mean, it's blunt, it's obvious, for me, it just did not work. I mean, yes, the story is compelling, the culture is fascinating, you know, the particular lines that get drawn from culture to culture is really interesting. There's a tiny bit here about colonial expansion. I mean, there's one scene fairly early in the film where, you know, a grandfather is talking to a granddaughter and they go up to the top of a hill and they say, look at this bay down here, this is where Captain Cook landed, and you see a modern building which is clearly a church, and you know that, and you say Captain Cook landed here, but we have kept our castom, we have kept our society going. And there's a speech towards the end of the film where a chief of this tribe stands up and says, the colonials came, we're still here, the Christians came, we're still here, the concept of money came, we're still here, we're still keeping to the old ways. So there is something of an idea here of a society being lost, about the modern world gradually encroaching on this tribal society. And there is some interest there, there is some value there. In fact, towards the end of the film, there's also a really, really interesting scene. I mean, because these two young lovers have run away, you know, their tribe doesn't want them to be together, this arranged marriage must happen to keep peace. So they've run away to be together. And they meet somebody on the beach and they say, I can't take you in because I still keep to Castom. But over there, there's a Christian village. They don't care about the old ways. You might go there, you might be safe there. So they go to this Christian village. And in my mind, as this was happening, I was thinking, oh, really? The Christians are going to save the day? And I was thinking in my mind, oh, maybe this is why Academy members latched onto this film, because the Christians come in and save the day. But no, it's a really, really fascinating scene. I mean, the quote-unquote Christianity which this village is practicing is not any version of Christianity I've ever seen. And it seems clear to me that the god they are worshipping is exactly the same as the old god they would have been worshipping if they had kept to Castom, if they had kept to the old Polynesian ways. And eventually the guy says to the girl, these people are kind of freaking me out. I think we should take our chances in the forest. And they run away. So this scene in the Christian village is very, very short. And I think beautiful, particularly speaking as an atheist. I think this film's view on Christianity, on the incursion of the modern outside world on this society, is kind of biting and kind of perfect. So I did like that. And I have to say, there is a lot of stuff to like about this film. It is beautifully shot. I mean, the visuals, the imagery, particularly when they go to the edge of this active volcano and there are certain scenes which are backlit by, you know, spumes of molten lava. I mean, it's beautiful, it's dramatic, it's intense, it's really, really well filmed. The information we get about the society, I mean, this Castom system, which is seemingly still in existence of Vanuatu, or was certainly in existence in 1987. I mean, those ideas are fascinating, but that's just not enough. That's just not enough for me to say this is a compelling feature film that I can recommend. And it is definitely not a film which is worthy of an Oscar nomination. I mean, when I look at the list of films which did not make the list of nominees, films like From Afar from Venezuela, Chevalier from Greece, Elle from France, which I've just seen through extra legal means, even Julieta from Spain, which I didn't particularly like myself, but I can understand why it has been loved by so many people. Even the documentary Fire at Sea from Italy, which actually got a documentary nomination, but didn't end up with a foreign language Oscar nomination. I mean, that is, in my opinion, a much better film as well. So there were so many films which are, in my opinion, so much better than this film, which didn't get a sniff of an Oscar nomination. So this making the cut? This making the final five? No way in hell. I mean, it's okay, I guess. There are certainly things to like about it. But honestly, at the end of the day, I just cannot recommend this film. I mean, this is one of those films you are really, really going to have to search for. I mean, this screening I've just been at was the only screening in Bath or Bristol for the entire week. So it's very unlikely to be able to see it at the cinema. I'm guessing this is a film which is, if not already out on VOD, then out soon on VOD. But honestly, I can say it's just not worth it. I can't recommend this film. It's just not good enough. One odd thing I meant to mention in that field recorded review, but forgot, was the fact that the colonial aspects of this film are somewhat interesting. This is a film where the modern world has clearly encroached somewhat onto this tiny Vanuatan island. There is a church, there are people going around in modern dress, or at least modern dress for 1987, but this is a tribal society, a traditional society. And yet, there is a fairly significant supporting character who is named Capan Kirk. Clearly named after Captain Kirk, who, quote-unquote, discovered Vanuatu back in the 18th century. And I thought that was rather interesting. And, you know, here's this guy wearing, you know, reeds, essentially, and he's named Capan Kirk. Odd. But, yes, that is the kind of thing that is interesting and does tell us something about traditional Vanuatan culture, but I honestly think this would have been much, much better as an ethnographic documentary. As a feature film, it just doesn't work for me. It is, ultimately, a Romeo and Juliet star-crossed lovers type story that we have seen many, many times before. It's interesting that it's based on a true story. It's interesting that the entire cast is made of these traditional Yakel tribes people. And it is stunningly beautiful. I mean, the cinematography is outstanding in this film. But honestly, it's just not enough for me. I can't say I can recommend this film. And weirdly, from what I can gather at time of recording, I can't find any evidence that this film is actually coming out on VOD. I'm guessing at some point you'll be able to find it streaming somewhere, but right now I can't find any evidence that it's actually going to be available, so the chances of you being able to see this film are very, very remote. And honestly, I don't think it's worth the effort. It's kind of interesting, it's okay, but it's really not good enough.
I'm feeling adventurous tonight. Let's take things a little further, shall we?
A Cure for Wellness is directed by Gore Verbinski, whose first real break in Hollywood came when he made the American remake of the Japanese horror film The Ring. He then went on to make the first three Pirates of the Caribbean movies, i.e. the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, which were actually pretty good. Since then, they have distinctly dropped in quality. And after those, he took a detour into animation and actually got himself an Oscar for directing Rango. But his last feature film before this was 3 years ago, and it was The Lone Ranger. And that tentpole flop meant he's been in director's jail ever since, and has had to make this film on a much smaller scale with a much smaller budget, and most of the money has actually come from Germany to make this film. And it tells the story of Dane DeHaan, who plays an up-and-coming financial analyst who is coerced by his bosses to go to Switzerland, because the CEO of this financial company is staying at a Swiss spa and is refusing to come back. So Dane DeHaan has to go to Switzerland to this exclusive remote spa in order to pick up the CEO of his company, played by Harry Groener. Once he gets there, he tries without success to find Harry Groener, and on the way back down the mountain to a local hotel, he is in a car crash and breaks his leg. So he is forced to stay at this spa, surrounded by rich patrons taking the cure, including Celia Imrie. But as he recuperates from this broken leg, he starts suspecting that something very, very wrong is going on in this spa. And he is consistently seeing a mysterious young girl played by Mia Goth. And he starts wondering if this spa and its head doctor, played by Jason Isaacs, is actually the front for something very, very disturbing. This is a film that kind of came out of nowhere. I did not know this film was coming out. It was not on my radar at all. But then I saw it included in a package that the Odeon Cinema put together saying, look, here are the big blockbusters that are coming out in the spring. And it was things like the Lego Batman movie and Logan and even 50 Shades Darker. You know, films I knew about, films I was expecting. But they also included clips from this film, A Cure for Wellness. And I thought, what the hell's that? That kind of looks like it might be interesting. And then I saw it was directed by Gore Verbinski, and it starred Dane DeHaan and Jason Isaacs, two actors I really, really liked. So despite not really knowing what I was getting when I went into this film, I was kind of interested in it, and I thought it was worth checking out. So was this tale of mysterious goings-on in a Swiss spa worth watching? You can hear my thoughts after the trailer for A Cure for Wellness.
We'd like you to go to Switzerland and bring Mr. Pembroke back to us.
What do we offer here? It's a process of purification away from the pressures of the modern world.
You plan to take Mr. Pembroke back with you?
Is that a problem?
He's a patient, not a prisoner.
You here for the cure?
No. Actually, I was just leaving.
No one ever leaves.
Welcome back, Mr. Lockhart.
Signs of concussion? Depleted immune system. I would like to recommend a treatment.
Think of it as a cleansing of the mind.
As much as the body.
Some patients experience visions. But rest assured, it's just the toxins leaving the system.
There's a terrible darkness here.
That was 200 years ago.
This is happening now. You said no one ever leaves. What happens to them? I saw the bodies!
Listen to yourself. You're not a well man.
You're trying to make me think I'm insane.
What's happening to me?
It's all part of the cure.
There is no cure!
So, it is Sunday night. The night of the Oscars. And you find me sat in a rather damp Queen Square, about to walk home, having come out of the Odeon Cinema where I saw A Cure for Wellness, which is definitively not an Oscar film. This is dumb as a box of rocks. I think what's happened here, I mean, and I don't know this for sure, but it feels like what has happened here is that Gore Verbinski and the screenwriter, who was Justin Hayes or something like that, Gore Verbinski and the screenwriter came up with this idea of a girl in a bath full of eels and then worked backwards. I mean, and this is not a spoiler because it's in the trailer, it's on the poster. You know, the central image of this film is a girl in a bath of eels, and they had to come up with the story to fit that. And I had an interesting experience with this film. It kind of reminded me of my experience of watching the film Morgan, which was roughly a year ago, actually. I mean, but here we have a B-movie. It is a relatively high-budget B-movie with pretty good production values, I have to say, and a talented filmmaker behind it. I mean, there are certain images in this film, certain shot choices, which are really, really good stuff. I mean, Gore Verbinski is still a talented filmmaker, but it's a dumb, dumb movie. I mean, I was watching it, and I was thinking, all right, I think I can work out already what is going on in this film. I mean, this is, you know, within the first 20 minutes, half hour of the film. Oh, and by the way, there is absolutely no earthly reason why this film should be 2.5 hours long. I mean, it's ridiculously long for what it is. But regardless, I was sitting there watching it thinking, right, this is a B-movie. I think I know what is going to happen, what's going on. And with one minor variation, which I honestly should have thought of myself, that's exactly what it was. I mean, I worked out what this film was, where it was going, very early. Which is exactly the same thing that happened with me and Morgan. And it's relatively standard stuff. I mean, there's stuff here which really reminded me of other films. Guillermo del Toro's film, was it Crimson Peak? Yeah, that was it. Guillermo del Toro's film Crimson Peak was one that came to mind. Inception, in a weird kind of way, came to mind. Even Jacob's Ladder kind of came to mind. There's certain parallels here with Jacob's Ladder. And oddly, Paolo Sorrentino's Youth as well, with lots of naked old people in a European spa. But, yeah, I mean, there's lots of stuff that came to mind. There's nothing especially original. I mean, some of the production values are excellent. The filmmaking in places is excellent. It's got a sense of disquiet, an unsettling feeling throughout the majority of the film. There are a couple of really, really uncomfortable scenes in slightly different ways. I mean, there's one scene involving torture of teeth, and I was not the only one in the screening, and it was a relatively full screening for a Sunday night. It's about half full, you know, pretty good, and I was not the only one wincing and reacting to, you know, the scene of torture of teeth. I mean, that was no. And there's another scene which is really unsettling in a completely different way, because it's basically a scene of attempted sexual assault. And that was, you know, stuff I didn't necessarily want to be seeing. But apart from those sort of, like, you know, genuine shock moments, it's basically unsettling. It's disquieting. You know, and there's lots and lots of stuff of eels. I mean, I think it's very pointed and very noticeable that, you know, the big wrought iron gates of this Swiss spa have intertwined eels coming up the centre of them. I mean, it's almost like the caduceus, you know, the Greek symbol of a doctor, but with eels. You know, it's interesting. But, yeah, lots of icky stuff involving eels. I mean, if slimy things bother you, then maybe you will have issues with it. But yeah, I mean, nothing really unsettling apart from those two moments in two different ways, and nothing else. I mean, I don't really see what the point of this film is. I mean, it's not truly disturbing or truly unsettling enough to be an out-and-out horror film. It doesn't explore its psychological themes deeply enough to be a psychological thriller. There's some really interesting stuff you could have explored with Dane DeHaan and his father and that relationship. I mean, some sort of things you could say about the trauma of childhood going on into adulthood. There is some stuff you could have done there, but it really doesn't go there. I mean, it's not deep on any particular level. It doesn't shine on any particular level. It's just there. I mean, it's got some kind of okay imagery, some kind of okay ideas. The acting's fine. I mean, you know, Dane DeHaan and Jason Isaacs, pretty good actors, you know, actors I respect, and they're okay. I mean, they're kind of phoning it in. I mean, I've never seen this girl Mia Goth before. I mean, that's such a perfect name. It has to be her real name. I mean, I can't imagine she picked that as a stage name. I mean, either that's her real name or she started out in porn, basically. And I doubt she started out in porn. She seems young. I mean, she's playing young. But, yeah, I mean, she's fine. I mean, the mysterious one girl in the distance. I mean, and you have Celia Imrie being a total Basil exposition, which really doesn't make sense because, as, you know, this exposition is being delivered by Celia Imrie, I was thinking, A, how is she finding out this stuff? And B, how come nobody else has found this out in the 200 intervening years between what she's talking about and now? I mean, you know, there's this big, deep mystery which happened 200 years ago, which, you know, people know a surprising amount about, and a surprisingly accurate amount about. I mean, it's kind of, you know, a bit like Transylvania, you know, the dark goings on in the castle, and yet people are surprisingly accurate about what actually happened even 200 years later. I mean, because we need it as exposition. I mean, they try to build up the myth aspect of it, the folklore aspect of it, but the information is so correct and so accurate that it doesn't feel like myth or folklore. It feels like exposition, and that's a problem. I mean, and then, you know, when a lot of it is coming out of the mouth of Celia Imrie, someone who probably shouldn't really know this stuff, then it's even more noticeable. I mean, there's some shoddy script writing going on here, and yeah, I mean, on pretty much every level, it's just not good enough. I mean, it's a B-movie. It's absolutely a B-movie. And if you're in the mood for a B-movie, then this is a really good example. I mean, like I said, the filmmaking is fine. Some of the imagery is really good. Some of the editing and the moments of surprise is good. But ultimately, it's a bog-standard B-movie and pretty much nothing more than that. I mean, there's... I honestly am asking myself, what's the point? Because it doesn't do any one thing good enough to say it deserved to be made. I mean, you watch it and you think, yeah, okay, and just move on. I mean, there's nothing, nothing to grip you, nothing to grab you. I mean, it's there and it's gone. I mean, really, not particularly worth it. I mean, maybe it's worth it for some of the imagery, and if you are interested in the imagery, it's probably worth watching on the big screen. But otherwise, maybe catch it on TV at some point, maybe get it on VOD or Netflix when you don't have to pay for it. But honestly, it's just blah. So, a quasi fact check. Mia Goth is actually her real name. But in a way, she did kind of get her break in porn, because her first major acting role was in Nymphomaniac Part 2. And probably off the back of that, she's actually been married to Shia LaBeouf for about 6 months, which is kind of interesting. And between Nymphomaniac and this film, her only other feature film appearance was a tiny role in Baltasar Kormákur's Everest. So, yeah, she kind of looks like a goth, and her name is genuinely goth. And I think she's talented. I think she does have a future. But probably not off the back of this film. This has been an absolute disaster at the box office. It has a production budget of about $40 million, and so far worldwide it has made about $17 million. And that is not even including the fact that they actually bought a Super Bowl advert for this film. And that's about $5 million off the marketing budget straight away. So this film has absolutely tanked. Which is a little bit of a shame, because there is some interesting stuff here. I mean, I am incredibly impressed that this film only cost $40 million because it looks like it cost at least double that. The production values, the shooting style are really, really good. And Gore Verbinski is a really, really talented director. But this material is just not good. It's a B-movie, and it turns... It's rather unsettling, rather disquieting plots. I mean, or everything that's been built up, the atmosphere that has been built up throughout the majority of the film, turns into absolute gothic craziness in the last 20 minutes, half an hour. And it's just not worth it. I really hope that people still take chances on Gore Verbinski, because he does have talent and he does have an interesting eye. I mean, there are certain shots in this. I mean, like, there's one in the opening scene, which is a panning shot across a floor, and you see an image through the bottom of an empty water glass. And it is a striking, interesting image. And there are lots of striking, interesting images in this film. Visually, I have absolutely no problems with this film at all. But the plot and the script is just not enough. It's not good enough. So it's frustrating, because on one level, I kind of want to recommend it for the visuals. But the visuals are in service of such a poor film, such a poorly constructed set of ideas, that I just can't say it's worth it. So it's a shame. This could and maybe should have been better, but it just isn't, and I can't recommend it.
Ich liebe dich.
It's Only the End of the World is the Canadian floss for 2017, and is directed by Xavier Dolan, one of the enfants terribles of world cinema. He is 27 years old and has made 7 films. He's fit an entire filmmaking career in before he's even reached 30. It's extraordinary, and his previous films have been very good, usually dealing with LGBT themes and familial problems which arise from them. He has been submitted by Canada 3 times to the foreign language Oscar race for I Killed My Mother, Mommy, and this film, It's Only the End of the World, and he has won the jury prize at Cannes 2 times. For Mommy and for this film. So he is a highly respected director, and probably because of that, he has managed to gather together a really, really good cast for this film, which is based on a play by Jean-Luc Lagasse. And it tells the story of a young playwright, played by Gaspard Ulliel, who goes home to his small hometown and his family, who he has not seen for 12 years, in order to tell them he is dying. He has a mother, Nathalie Baye, an older brother, Vincent Cassel. Vincent Cassel's wife, played by Marion Cotillard, and his kid sister, played by Léa Seydoux. And as he returns home after such a long time away, and the family gathers together for lunch together, Gaspard Ulliel is constantly trying to find the right moment to tell his family that this is probably the last time they will see him. Despite being such a respected director, And despite the fact this film did win the jury prize at Cannes in 2016, this film was hated by critics. It's currently standing at 47% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is incredibly bad for a director of such stature. So I was really interested in seeing it, because there is a real disconnect between the critical reaction to this film and the awards-worthy consideration of this film. I mean, it did win the jury prize, and it actually ended up as one of the 9-film long list for nomination as Best Foreign Language Film this year. So when something like this happens, I am really, really curious to see what's going on and which side of the fence I will come down on. And I do like the work of Xavier Dolan. I mean, I think Mommy was brilliant and I think deserved a foreign language Oscar nomination, what was it, 3 years ago now. And his other films have been excellent as well. I mean, Tom at the Farm is brilliant and heartbreaking and devastating. So I really do like Xavier Dolan, and I wanted to see if I thought this was a misstep by this talented young director. But which side of the fence would I come down on? Is this the mistake that the critics thought, or the outstanding piece of work that the awards have thought? Here are my thoughts on It's Only the End of the World. So it's a damp Tuesday afternoon in the Harborside area of Bristol, and you find me sat across the hall from the Watershed Cinema, where I've just seen It's Only the End of the World. Now, as I was watching this film, there were two references, two other films, which constantly kept coming to mind. One of them is one I've been talking about frequently over the last month or so, and the other one is not going to be a particularly helpful reference because it's a film basically nobody's seen yet, but I did see it at the London Film Festival, and it's another film up for the Foreign Language Oscar in 2017. It was submitted to the Foreign Language Oscar in 2017. The two films that came to mind were Denzel Washington's Fences and the Romanian floss for 2017, Sierra Nevada, directed by Cristi Puiu, because this is a film, like Fences, which I can clearly, clearly see has been adapted from a play. It's not even attempting to hide it. And like Sierra Nevada, the Romanian floss, it's about a family meal which gets way, way out of hand, and people are talking about stuff that isn't actually relevant to what's going on, or rather, they are talking about irrelevant stuff, so they don't talk about the important stuff. And that's a common theme of both It's Only the End of the World and Sierra Nevada. And honestly, Sierra Nevada did it better. Although I didn't particularly like Sierra Nevada because it's way, way too long. And this is a tight 90 minutes or so. So, I mean, I've got no issues with the length of It's Only the End of the World. But I honestly don't think it works very well. It does have this awkward structure where we have very clearly defined scenes. You know, we have the scene of the awkward reintroduction as Gaspard Ulliel goes into his family house for the first time in 12 years, and then he has individual scenes, individual moments with the other four people. And interspersed with that, there is, you know, an awkward lunch and an awkward, you know, coffee and dessert scene, which ends really, really well. I mean, the acting, I mean, similar to Fences, it's really, really well acted, but it definitely feels like a play at every single point. The only thing I will say about the cast is, much as I love Léa Seydoux, and let's be honest here, Léa Seydoux is hot, but the character she's playing, as written, she comes across as like she's supposed to be 17, 18. And talented as Lea Seydoux is, and hot as Lea Seydoux is, she can no longer pass for 17. So I think she was miscast, even though she is very good in the film. I think it's just the wrong role for her. Vincent Cassel is excellent, particularly in this final scene with the coffee and dessert, which goes completely out of hand. But everybody is really good. I mean, and there's so many layers going on here. I mean, as I said, there's a lot of dialogue. This is a very, very dialogue-heavy film. And it is a situation where they're talking about everything and nothing because they can't talk about what's actually important. I mean, as the film progresses, people gradually start working out for themselves that there is something wrong with Gaspard Ulliel. And because they don't want to deal with that, they, you know, talk about really inconsequential stuff. And it's a really interesting situation because on the one hand, this is, you know, a man returning to the bosom of his family, but he has not seen them for 12 years. I mean, yes, he sends them a postcard on their birthday every day. So, I mean, really, a postcard? But, you know, he sends them a postcard on their birthday every year. But that's it. That's all the contact they've had. I mean, yes, they know he's this big, famous playwright off in the big city. Or maybe off in a different country. It's never specifically said. But, you know, they know he's this big, successful writer. But they just haven't had contact with him. And this affects the relationship that everybody has with Gaspard Ulliel. I mean, Lea Seydoux, I mean, like I said, the character she's playing seems to be written about 17. And, you know, this is 12 years she has not seen her brother. So, I mean, she was a kid when he left. And yes, she cuts out all the clippings of his, you know, reviews of his plays and everything, and she gets this postcard every year, but she kind of resents the fact that her brother has abandoned her, and she definitely resents the fact that her mother still treats her like a kid, even though, you know, she drives her own car and, you know, smokes massive amounts of dope. And then we have Marion Cotillard playing Gaspard Ulliel's sister-in-law, who is very shy, very introverted. And as the film progresses, we realise that she's kind of been cowed by her husband. But she is very intelligent. I mean, she is the first person to realise, hang on a minute, there's a distinct reason why Gaspard Ulliel is here. I mean, this is somebody she has never met before. I mean, she's been married to Gaspard Ulliel's brother for 12 years. They've got an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old kid, one of whom is named after Gaspard Ulliel. Yet they've never met, so that's an awkward situation. And because to some degree she's an outsider, she's the first one that picks up, wait a minute, there's something up here, there's something bad here. And, you know, so she is very meek and very introverted. I mean, honestly, I have never seen Marion Cotillard play a character this introverted. I mean, even in something downbeat like 2 Days, 1 Night, she still had her big moments. She still had something to sink her teeth into. But here she's sort of like the mousy woman in the corner who's been browbeaten by her husband. And speaking of her husband, we have Vincent Cassel, who is a fascinating character. And you realise, the more the film goes on, that he is deeply resentful of his brother for going off and becoming famous while he's still stuck in the same small town and married to Marion Cotillard, and not particularly happily married to Marion Cotillard. And he's boorish. He's kind of monstrous. I mean, he's the one who makes insensitive and ill-advised comments about Gaspard Ulliel's homosexuality, because, you know, Kel Surprise, Xavier Dolan, made a film about a gay man having issues with his family. I mean, that's a de rigueur for Xavier Dolan. But anyway, he's insensitive at best and outright hostile at worst about his brother's sexuality. He really does not treat his wife well. He constantly belittles and dismisses his wife. And at certain places he does get, you know, borderline verbally abusive. I mean, he's not a good guy, and yet there is still this thing that he wants his family to be together. He wants this unity, and he feels he's been slighted when his brother went off. So this unity has been shattered, and he deeply resents this. And then there's, you know, the mother, Natalie Bai, who comes across as sort of like the dotty old woman, the batty woman who everybody has to tolerate, everybody has to put up with her crazy ideas and everything. But in certain points, you realise she is really, really shrewd. She too kind of sees that there's something up, but she has some really insightful observations about her family and the relationships her family has. So she portrays herself as this batty old woman, but there's a spark there, there's some intelligence there, and yeah, every performance is nicely nuanced, nicely balanced. The way they all interact with each other is really good, but it really, really comes across like a stage play. I mean, it's not quite as bad as Fences or The Pass, because there are certain moments where there are flashbacks to earlier points in history, and these just happen. I mean, something comes up in conversation and we instantly go to a flashback of that happening, and it's kind of artistic, it's kind of unexpected, or you haven't quite seen it done that way. I mean, there's a scene with a bird at the end of the film which is almost surrealist. So I mean, it's not entirely constrained by the format of the stage play, but it definitely feels like that for large stretches. And it has also been shot in a really interesting way, because the vast majority of this film is shot in extreme close-up of everybody's faces, all the characters' faces. I mean, these are you there, and it's Marion Cotillard's face filling the entire screen, and you know, Gaspard Ulliel's face filling the entire screen. I mean, it's a little disconcerting. I mean, it's not something I've ever seen done that consistently throughout that much of the film. So, yeah, that's kind of weird, but yeah, it's well done. I mean, I did read the credits because there was a track I thought I recognised, but it turned out I didn't. Oh, and that's another interesting choice. All the music that I recognised in this film was at least 10 years old. So I'm not sure what that says. I'm not sure why Xavier Dolan made that choice, but all the music is at least 10 years old. But because I wanted to see what the music was, I read all the credits. And Xavier Dolan actually wrote the English subtitles, which I think is rather cool. But yeah, it's got an interesting visual style. I'm not entirely sure it works, but it does come across very, very much like a play. It comes across like a not exceptionally well done adaptation of a play. I mean, I think he did a better job than Denzel Washington did with Fences, but it still comes across very much like a dialogue heavy play. And the conclusions the film comes to wasn't 100% satisfying for me. I mean, there comes a certain point you think, oh, that's probably how it's going to end. But for me, it wasn't 100% satisfying. So, I kind of understand the mixed reactions that this film has been getting. I mean, the critics have hated it. But, you know, the jury at Cannes and the committee who selected the Canadian Foreign Language Oscar submission, basically two groups made up of actors, made up of Hollywood people, or, you know, Quebec film industry people, whoever. I mean, made up of film people, people who make films rather than people who critique films. I mean, the filmmakers seem to have liked it, and the film critics seem to have hated it. And I get that, because this is definitely an acting showcase. This is five really talented actors doing really good, impactful work. And I think it's easy to latch onto that. It's easy to respect that if you are a performer, if you are in the filmmaking industry. But as a cinematic product, as an experience you have, for me, it just didn't quite work. I don't think this is going to end up being one of my personal Fronog Oscar nominees for this year. I doubt it'll make the shortlist, even though it did in real life. So, it's an okay film, but honestly, this is one I can't strongly recommend. If you're a fan of the work of Xavier Dolan, I think this is possibly his most conventional film. So, I mean, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing in your mind, I'm not sure. But it's good enough. I liked it, but I can't say I strongly recommend it. So, yeah, take that for what you will. So I think at the end of the day, I do come down on the side that this film was a misstep by Xavier Dolan. Similarly to Fences, the acting is excellent, the dialogue is excellent, but it doesn't quite come down as a great film, as a great piece of cinema. It is really disconcerting having these extreme close-ups of the performers as they are acting. And there's not enough of the flashbacks and the tiny moments of surrealism to say it is a cinematic experience worth having. I think it's interesting, but I don't think it's going to be one of my favourite foreign language films of the year. I don't think it's going to be in my personal list of the 2017 foreign language Oscar submissions. It's just okay. And from such a talented director, that's just not good enough. Xavier Dolan's next film, which is apparently being completed and is currently in post-production, is actually in English, and he shot it in Harrow, which is very interesting. So, yeah, I'm fascinated to see what Xavier Dolan comes up with in the English language. But for this film, for me, it just wasn't quite good enough.
Would you like a happy ending?
So even though the Oscars is now over, it's still a really busy week this week with 4 cinematic releases I want to check out, as well as quite a bit of extra stuff as well. Out in the cinema this coming weekend is Logan, the latest and supposedly last film that Hugh Jackman will be making as the Wolverine character. It's supposedly somewhat based on the very famous comic book series Old Man Logan, and has also been made as an R-rated film in the States and a 15 film here. Unlike the PG-13 12A films that the X-Men films have been up until this point. So it seems like it will be a lot more violent and a lot more nihilistic than we have come to expect from the X-Men films and indeed Marvel films in general. The buzz I've been hearing about this film has been very, very positive, and I'm fascinated to see what Logan is. And away from the blockbuster end of the spectrum, I've also got a couple of smaller films, and indeed a foreign language film. Out next week is Viceroy's House, which looks like a typical period, British, borderline Oscar-worthy film, starring Hugh Bonneville and Gillian Anderson as the last occupiers of the Viceroy's house in India as Indian independence is achieved. Now, this wouldn't usually be the kind of film I would definitely choose to seek out, the kind of film pitched at a slightly older audience pitched with a certain niceness about it. But I'm really fascinated by the fact that this film has been directed by Gurinder Chadha, the Indian director who directed The Lunchbox, which was cruelly snubbed by India for the foreign language Oscar race a couple of years back, because The Lunchbox was really, really good. And I'm fascinated to see what an Indian director does with this story of Indian independence with a British cast, or, you know, a British-American cast, at least. So I am interested in Viceroy's House, and I will be checking it out. At the really obscure art house end, we have Certain Women, the latest film from Kelly Reichardt, who directed Night Moves and Meek's Cut Off. She is a director who revels in long, slow, languorous films. And I can go either way with that kind of film, but I really, really did like Night Moves. And this film, Certain Women, has been getting a lot of buzz. It was actually named as Best Film at the London Film Festival in 2016. And one of its supporting actresses got a certain amount of buzz as Best Supporting Actress at the Oscars, but it was never likely to happen because she's a Native American in a tiny independent film. But it does sound really interesting, and it has been getting very good reviews. It's based on three short stories written by Mayla Malloy, set in rural Wyoming. It stars people like Laura Dern, Michelle Williams, and Kristen Stewart, telling stories of women trying to survive and thrive in the Western Plains of America in the modern day, but still with the sexist attitudes that people seem to have, or at least that seems to be what the film's about. But it's got a really good cast. It's by a director I do respect, even though I'm cautious about her filmmaking style. So I definitely will be checking out Certain Women. And as far as the foreign language film realm goes, I will also be checking out The Student, which is a Russian film which, reading between the lines, might have fallen afoul of the Russian authorities. It's directed by renowned Russian director Kirill Serebrennikov, and the original title, the original Russian title of this film, is actually a play on words, combining the Russian words for student and martyr. But that's a pun that doesn't work in English, so it's just known as The Student. And it tells the story of a teenage boy who starts rebelling against his parents and rebelling against his school's authority by embracing an extreme form of religion. And as far as I can tell, this is a very direct and very pointed satire on the influence that the Russian Orthodox Church has on the modern state of Russia. And for those reasons, I'm not sure it's actually been shown in Russia, although it did play at the Cannes Film Festival and did do very well. So I think this is one of those films that one of two things is going to happen. Either it's going to be next year's foreign language Oscar submission from Russia, or it's going to be the obvious contender, which should have been Russia's submission to next year's foreign language Oscar race. And either way, it sounds really, really interesting. So I am going to be checking out the Russian film The Student. Also, next weekend at the Watershed Cinema in Bristol, there is a touring program of South Korean films. I think it's one of those things where the South Korean embassy has put together a program of films and sent it to art house films around the country. I mean, Japan does that. Spain does that. France has done it in the past, although I haven't seen one of those for a while. But occasionally you do get these things. I mean, it's being marketed as a taste of South Korean cinema. And there are a couple of films I am definitely wanting to check out. Because this year's South Korean floss, The Age of Shadows, is part of this programme. And also the film that everybody expected to be this year's South Korean floss, The Handmaiden, the latest film from Park Chan-wook, which has been getting really, really good reviews coming out of America. So I'm definitely interested in seeing both of those films and making up my own mind as to which I would have chosen for South Korea to be sent to the Oscars. That is coming up this weekend, but I think both of those films are getting general releases in the cinema in the next couple of weeks and months. So while I might well watch those films this coming weekend, I'm not sure I'll be releasing the reviews in the next couple of episodes. But I might, so I'm giving you warning that you might be hearing some reviews of South Korean films in the next couple of weeks. And also, there's a really surprising film which has just shown up on Netflix as well. It's called I Don't Belong in This World Anymore. And it actually won the jury prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. And yet, almost immediately, it has shown up on Netflix. I heard that it was bought by Netflix in the States. But when that happens, a lot of these films get some kind of cinematic release here in the UK. But not only has that not happened in this case, it's shown up about a month after the Sundance Film Festival wrapped up. So, yeah, I'm really, really curious in this because it is a major award winner at the Sundance Film Festival, and it's from really interesting people. It's the directorial feature-length debut of Macon Blair, who is the cohort of Jeremy Saulnier. He was the star of Blue Ruin, and he also had a major supporting role in Green Room. But now he's a director, and he has directed this film, which stars Melanie Lynskey and Elijah Wood. So a really impressive cast for this tiny indie film from a first-time director. And it tells the story of Melanie Lynskey, who's a depressed and isolated woman whose house gets robbed, and she has to team up with her obnoxious neighbour, played by Elijah Wood, in order to track down the culprits and work out what's happened. So it seems like it might be a slightly more comedic take on some of the themes that were in Blue Ruin. But anyway, it sounds fascinating, and it's also fascinating that this film, which won a pretty big award, has just been thrown onto Netflix. So yeah, at some point I will be checking out I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. So there's a lot of stuff coming up, and what I might do is put a review of that Netflix film I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore with my review of Logan, which is released this Thursday here in the UK, put that in a show together, and then have another show next week, which reviews the other general release films out this week, Certain Women, The Student, and Viceroy's House. I'm not exactly sure how things will work out. I'm not exactly sure how my time will be best spent. But within the next couple of weeks, you will be hearing reviews of Logan, Certain Women, Viceroy's House, The Student, and I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. as well as possibly the South Korean films The Age of Shadows and The Handmaiden. So lots of stuff coming up. I'm not sure exactly what will be in the next episode, but something will be coming fairly shortly. And until then, I'll say, this has been Raw Footage, the Stream of Consciousness film review show. I've been your host, Colin Gaisley from Bath, England, and I'll see you the next time I come out of the cinema and into your ears. Website is raw-footage.co.uk. Email is rawfootagepodcast@gmail.com. Intro music from the La La Land soundtrack. Outro music from the Moana soundtrack, both used with a liberal interpretation of fair use. Idents by Dr. Brandy's sexy voice of the Dark Corner podcast.
Okay. I see what's happening, yeah. You're face to face with greatness and it's strange. You don't even know how you feel. It's adorable. Well, it's nice to see that humans never change. Open your eyes, let's begin. Yes, it's really me, it's Maui, breathe it in. I know it's a lot, the hair, the bod, when you're staring at a demigod. What can I say except you're welcome? For the tides, the sun, the sky. Hey, it's okay, you're welcome. I'm just an ordinary demigod. Hey, what has two thumbs and pulled up the sky when you were waddling yay high? This guy, when the nights got cold, who stole you fire from down below? Look at him, yo. Oh, also I lassoed the sun. You're welcome to stretch your days and bring you fun. Also I harnessed the breeze. You're welcome to fill your sails and shake your trees. So what can I say?